Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Welcome back to Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. This series is about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region. As previously mentioned, the Free Church was started in 1884 when 22 churches, comprised mainly by Swedish immigrants with similar beliefs of church government and biblical doctrines, agreed to cooperate to support home and foreign missions. The goal of the mission effort was to share the gospel to the world, and Congo was one of those areas. They wanted to go to Congo to start churches, train up leaders to continue with the work of the church in an autonomous manner. I decided to do this series on the history of the Free Church mission work because my family was part of the effort for 25 years in the 1960s through 1990. Many of the events in this series involved me and my parents. Much of the early work had helped establish a functioning mission, but much happened during my family's tenure, so I felt that sharing the journey from the beginning, as well as the stories of all those that passed away during that effort, was important. Furthermore, there is a lot of information and history that will be shared that has never been heard or documented, and I'm glad to have captured it to preserve it for future generations. This is episode 3 of 7. The first episode told the story of the work of the Free Church Mission starting in the early 1920s, led by the vision of Titus Johnson. The work faced considerable challenges. It included slow communications, health issues, lack of medical care, minimal funds, and bureaucracy. Many succumbed to sickness and disease. Yet the pioneers worked hard, showed patience, and persevered to have established 3 mission stations by 1936. The second episode covered adding more mission stations from 1936 to 1947. And Arthur Skoglund, Beverly Thornbloom, Marion Nelson, and Ruth Robinson dying in Congo. In Marion's case, she lost her life in the Atlantic Ocean. In this episode, we will share about several more mission stations being located and started, as well as a child and adult that died during the period from 1948 to 1952. The baton pass from the missionaries to the Congolese church also started to occur about this time, and the push for the church to be autonomous began.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
Wanting to continue to expand their footprint, the MEU made 8 survey and evangelistic trips into the northeast area near the Ubangi River. This area was about a 2-day truck trip from Karawa. Survey trips started in 1942 by both Covenant and Free Church missionaries. Other trips ensued for another 6 years, when they selected a temporary site in 1948 to establish a mission station. Then, in February 1949, the Norwegian Baptists ceded their field area west of the Uele River to the MEU. Initially, 2 Congolese teachers were sent up to the area to open a school, and 123 kids were enrolled the first year. They named the station Wasolo. Dan Noren, who lived at Wasolo for several years as a child, elaborates on the location of the mission station. Apparently, the Catholic priests held a lot of sway in nearby Yakoma, and when the mission applied for property, they were steered way inland to an undesirable area.
The Catholic priests back in the day, they gave us the roughest place in the world. They sent us inland on top of a hill where there was no water. And that was on purpose because they didn't want the Protestants there. And of course, the Catholic mission is right down there at Yakoma, right on the Uele River. They had a beautiful place. And they sent the Protestant missionaries way in on a hill, but it was the most scenic place.
They saw the need for medical treatments there, so doctors and nurses visited periodically for several years. They were overwhelmed with patients. Government permission to begin work at the Wasolo site was granted September 9, 1950, and clearing the 123-acre site was begun. In 1951, the first missionary dwelling was built. It was mud construction with a grass roof. Later, a cement floor was poured, and then a permanent cement structure was built, and a few other homes were also constructed. One of the interesting issues at Wasolo in the early years was the proliferation of white ants and millipedes. Millipedes are big black creatures about 6 to 8 inches long. Thousands of them would come out of the forest and be a huge nuisance for several months each year. The staff had to learn how to avoid them and to deter them from taking over their house. Wasolo was established primarily as an evangelistic center. Art and Flo Lumblad started the work, followed by Quentin and Ruth Nelson. A more formal medical work had started with Dr. Almquist in charge in 1953, and the dispensary was overwhelmed with the health needs of the local population. It was in 1955 that the government provided subsidies to expand the school and build a hospital. It had a maternity/surgery ward and another small area for surgeries and a dispensary. 25 mud huts surrounded the hospital for patients to live in. The church building at Wasolo was completed in 1957. The final construction of the permanent buildings for the hospital was completed in 1960 with the dedication on June 1st. Dr. Dean and Gretchen Samuelson served in Congo for 19 years and spent 9 years living and working at Wasolo. I've asked him to describe the mission station.
Primarily forest. The mission station was off of the main roads because the Belgian government hadn't permitted them to be in any of the towns. The bottom of the hill, there was a hospital with 62 beds. Coming up the hill, there was a church. Crosses from the church were two school buildings that were used morning and afternoon, so we had four schools running, an elementary school and two middle schools and a high school. At the top of the hill, there were initially two missionary dwellings. One was a duplex, and the other was a single-family house where Paul Carlson had lived. While we were there, we built a third mission house and added a guest house onto the garage at the top of the hill.
What was the ministry of Wasolo?
It was an outpost for the farthest reaches of the CEUM. They had a hospital and 10 village health centers, but it was primarily medical and supporting the church work.
Gretchen shares about how the hospital served the needs of the entire area.
Well, Dean was the only doctor in an area the size of Iowa, so people would walk for several days to get to our station, carrying their sick patient with them. And totally amazing. We felt very isolated, very alone, but very useful also. And Dean said one time, he said, you know, I think every single day there's somebody who is now alive who would have died if they hadn't gotten here. But it was also very, very gratifying to see the help that these people did get just because we were there.
So how did they supply the homes and hospital with water?
There was a submersible pump that was run whenever the hospital generator was running, and it pumped to a water tower on the hill and another water tower down by the hospital.
Dean recounts one memory that was special for the station and local tribe, the Ngbandis.
It was a very exciting day when the Ngbandi translation of the New Testament arrived, and many people were really excited and amazed at what was in the Bible that they thought they had been reading for all their lives.
Gretchen shares her memories of Wasolo.
And I was working on a book ministry and trying to write simple little books that they could learn how to read and so on, and had a little bookstore. And, you know, that wouldn't have happened if we hadn't been there.
So though Wasolo started as a jumping off point for evangelism, the ministry emphasis shifted to medical work due to the needs of the local population. In the early 1940s, some of the missionaries had school-aged children, and many were being homeschooled. It was challenging, as usually the wife was doing that, but still had a ministry to attend to, or interruptions occurred throughout the day, disrupting the schooling. It was in 1948 that the MEU annual conference asked Dorothy Ford to set up a school for the children of missionaries. They used a storeroom at Kerawa in early 1949. She requested that desks and benches be made for the students, but when school started, they'd not been built. So she went to the workshop area, secured sawhorses and boards, and created makeshift benches and desks. It was certainly rudimentary. The first class had six kids. Three were Thornblooms, and three were Westbergs. In 1950, the dormitory was in the house known as Southern. For what it's worth, our family lived there from 1966 to 1967. Evelyn Norin arrived in May 1951 and taught for 1 year. In 1952, the food order had not arrived, so all the kids and Dorothy Ford moved the school to Tondala. Then, in 1953, they moved back to Kerawa. Dorothy Blakeway then arrived on the field to become one of the teachers at UBOC. She was my fourth grade teacher and taught countless kids until she retired in 1995, 42 years later. The mission saw Libengi as a strategic location, as it was a well-populated city, had considerable commerce, and a river port on the Ubangi River, along with a good airport. Libengi was not far from Kala, about 20 miles away. Foreign Missions Secretary H.G. Rodine and the missionaries got approval from the board to open a mission station there. So, Harry Anderson went to request permission from the administrator of Libengi to open a mission station there. The exchange went something like this.
I know you want to start a work here, but frankly, the people don't want you to be here.
To which Harry responded,
But sir, we are constantly getting requests from the villagers that moved to Libengi that they want us to have a work here and have a church here, and we have a couple that is ready to come and set up our work here.
At this, the administrator stopped being cordial and replied,
Don't argue with me. I'm in tune with the people here, and they don't want you. And they don't want you or any other Protestants here either.
The Belgian administrator had given his decision, so the meeting was over. The missionaries regrouped and appealed to the governor in Coquitville, hoping he would help get a positive decision. Weeks of waiting turned to months, and there was no news about getting permission to open Libengi. Finally, they got news that a decision had been made. The answer was no. So hoping to be up and running with a chapel built in May 1947 wasn't going to happen. Part of the resistance was that when the Belgians first took over Congo, they declared that only Catholics could be in larger cities. It took a while for that policy to change. A full year went by. Then on May 13th, 1948, the missionaries at Kala looked up to see the Sabena DC-4 flying overhead on its way to Libengi per its usual schedule. As it disappeared from view, the sound of its motors suddenly stopped. The next day, Monty Scholand, Norm Chapman, and Clarence Lumberg went to Libengi for some business and were flagged down on the road by the district administrator. He explained that the Sabena flight had crashed in the jungle in that area and searchers were needed to find the plane and look for survivors. Immediately, they parked the truck and ran into the jungle. It was thick with vines and trees and vegetation. They had to hack their way with machetes. They found the wreckage at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The initial assessment was that everyone aboard was dead. But as they approached the debris and shredded fuselage, taking it all in, they heard a groan. One man was alive with two broken legs. Unfortunately, the other 31 aboard were all dead. The administrator stayed at the plane to coordinate hauling the corpses out to the road for transporting to Libengi, while the missionary men offered to take the survivor to Lubengi's hospital. The decision was made to have a mass funeral service for all the crash victims and bury them at Libengi. Catholics and Protestants were among the dead. Songs were sung expressing joy and hope, and a short message was shared. The attendees had not heard the gospel and were surprised at the positive message and songs from the missionaries. It was a testimony that touched the community. Shortly after the plane crash and the funeral, permission was granted to the Free Church to open a mission station at Libengi. The missionaries were convinced that the three missionary men that had helped with the search and rescue of the plane, as well as the message of hope from the funeral, had much to do about changing the attitude of the Libengi official. The mission station started construction. One of the prominent Congolese pastors and evangelists, Isaac Palendo, moved to Libengi about this time and found the people surprisingly ready to hear the gospel. On June 14, 1952, the Norman Chapmans also moved there, the first Protestant missionaries to occupy Libengi. Then, in July, the church was dedicated. In 1953, the board granted funds for the construction of another house. In 1954, Ruby Nelson was assigned there as principal of the primary school. Libengi Mission Station had begun to function in this important center. The focus of the missionaries was to work in church planting in the area and support the three churches in Libengi. In the 1970s and 1980s, the focus moved towards education and literature. For much of the time, only one family lived at Libengi doing their ministry. Liz Anderson and Lita Thornton were at Libengi working in this area for many years. In the late 1980s, Bev Nyberg moved to Libengi and spent 3.5 years there. She lived with Linda Gustafson Spriegel. Here is Bev's description of the mission station.
Well, the mission station had two houses and a large storeroom full of bats. And at the time, Jack Dangers was there living in one of the houses to build a third house. And the big storeroom was full of books, book supplies, and Emmaus course supplies. And it had a bookstore on and off through there. Associated with the mission property and on the mission property were two other churches. And then when Jack Dangers left, then the one house that had been there was lived in by the Libengi regional director, the pastor there, who was our main point of contact while Linda and I lived there.
Producing and distributing literature and training materials became one of the emphases of Libengi. Bev further describes the ministries at Libengi.
I believe it was basically church planning and church building. I think back with Liz and Lita, in their day, they had a big thrust, again, with building the church through literature, writing, and distribution. And that hence the big literature storage building that was there on our station.
So was there good electricity and water provided to the mission station?
We occasionally had electricity. And when we had it, we enjoyed it. But that wasn't all that frequent. And so we had our own generator as well that we ran, you know, for 3.5 hours, 3 hours at night. And the water, again, it was primarily just our own cistern rainwater. And then sometimes people had to carry water if it was in dry season.
Being the only two missionaries at Libengi, Bev and Linda share this memory.
Well, one thing was that we were very independent because we were the only two missionaries there. So we were very immersed in the African culture. And then living next door to the Africa, that Libengi regional director there too. And so we were just more engaged. That was a special part. One thing Linda and I did was we were training youth directors for the churches and we did induction Bible studies. And it was always amazing the insights that came from a different perspective than what we would imagine. Just from their cultural perspective, which was a special sharing time for all of us. And interestingly enough, some of those same leaders later became church leaders and pastors, and it was just satisfying to see how they have grown and developed since that time. And also, I think we both did a lot of speaking at women's groups.
Another thing she remembers was the very large avocados growing in the front yard and other fruit trees around the yard that they enjoyed daily. And living on the Ubangi River meant fresh fish.
Another thing that was fun was having Nile perch. We got big Nile perch delivered to our door fresh, and we had the best recipe that we saved it for company in particular, but it was great.
One interesting tidbit about Libenge is shared by John Aiken, who visited Libenge often when he lived at Kala in the early 1970s.
They had the nicest outhouse around. It was all nicely covered on the inside with matting or with material that was very, very nice. So that when you went into her outhouse, boy, that was like, whew, I need to spend more time here. It was pretty nice.
I used that outhouse a few times. Yeah, I hung out in there longer than normal. Just saying. Libenge's mission helped establish the church work in the area and then shifted to being a part of the literature outreach with Christian courses, booklets, and other training materials being written and distributed throughout the entire Ubangi region. The mission had their eyes on another region that had five different tribes in that area, way north of Karawa. Will and Colleen Norton and Adola Anderson traveled to Baja in late February 1948, staying about 3 weeks. This was an exploratory trip to determine if a station should be established there. Baja is north of everything and the furthest north one could get in Congo, near the border. When they returned to Kala, they were excited about their trip. They reported that the statesmen, natives, and others were friendly and favorable towards establishing this new work. One of the Kala evangelists stayed there to, quote, start classes and protect the fruit that was planted, unquote. The 1948 Mission Yearbook also reported, quote, these very days we are taking steps to open a new mission station in the heart of this great northern field. This new station would be at Baja, unquote. H.G. Rodin was advocating for continued expansion and for starting a mission station, even though it would be a challenge and very remote. Baja was remote back when it opened in 1949 and was deemed remote and in the boonies when I was there in the mid-1960s to early 1980s. In fact, in all my years, I never visited Baja. I asked Jay Dangers, who lived there 6 years while growing up in the 1960s and early 1970s, to elaborate on Baja.
So it really is a forgotten place. Most missionaries, I'll bet, couldn't even name you the tribes that live there. If I recall right, there were five of them in that general area, Mono, Togbo, Bunziri, and I forget the other two now.
It wasn't a big station.
It was a very small station as far as buildings were concerned. There were three missionary houses, one that was called the Lundberg House. That's where we lived. And then there was the Lashbaugh's house that was empty almost the whole time I was there. And then Ruth Brown's house. Then there was a small garage, a light plant house, a radio house. And then down the short 50-meter palm lane to the road, the main road, and then across it there was a church and a primary school with about five classrooms and then a dispensary. That was the whole thing.
Jay shares what the main ministry was at Baja.
Well, it was definitely evangelism and supporting the local pastors. Lundy Lundberg and Jack Lashbaugh were evangelistic and involved in church planting. That's the main thing my dad did when he was there as well. And we would go from Baja to different villages and stay for a week at a time. And my dad would do evangelism and working with the pastors there.
He describes the topography.
Baja area was rolling hills, some fairly high but very gentle hills, grassland with short trees. The tallest trees around were about 10 to 15 feet tall, but generally it was short, scrubby trees.
So how did they get water?
There was a small well down the hill, but most of our water was just rainwater.
Here's a memory he'll never forget.
6 years old, a lightning bolt hit the ground in our yard, went across and up the pathway to the Loshbaugh's house where the single lady was living, and struck her, not badly, but it was a ball of lightning. And I had to look it up to make sure there is such a thing, and there is. So it did happen, and my dad saw it and told us about it, and you know, he and my mom ran over to take care of the single lady, but yeah, she was okay.
Despite being way off the beaten path and rarely visited by anybody, I asked Jay what made Bajja special.
Yeah, Bajja was my home. That, you know, I lived there when I was young, and then I lived there when I was older. And family memories would be a lot of it. I did enjoy hunting. I had some good Congolese friends that I really enjoyed. So, yeah, it was home.
Jay also noted that only 7 households ever lived at Bajja in all the years Bajja was in existence. It was a small station that wasn't on the way anywhere, surrounded by 5 different tribes. Yet kudos to those 7 families or single ladies that served way up at Bajja, bringing the gospel to the area and supporting the local church. Will and Colleen Norton went to Congo in 1940. They had gotten the call to serve in missions at Columbia Bible College. Their goal was to build and start the Bible Institute at Tandala. They had 3 boys at this point, Will Jr., Peter, and Seth. The missionaries from Tandala, including Will Norton, were out for a weekend conducting Big Sundays, which were large outreach services in various villages. His wife Colleen was home with their 3 boys and 7 months pregnant with their 4th child. Doris Nelson, a nurse, was asked to be present during the final stages of the pregnancy and was critical during the delivery and post-delivery. They'd planned to leave for the Kerwa Hospital to deliver under the care of Dr. Wally Thornbloom when she realized the little boy inside her had other plans. She was ready to give birth. Unfortunately, the shortwave radio wasn't working, so a quick message for a doctor to come didn't happen. A Congolese on a bicycle rode to the village to beckon Will to return to Tandala to be with Colleen. Later, a European doctor and Dr. Wally Thornbloom arrived to help with the delivery. I contacted Will Norton Jr., who was 7 and a half at the time, and he shares his memories of that day.
And so when we got to the house, through the screen door, Dr. Wally says, "Good morning. There's somebody here that you need to see." Then my dad took us to the little room where our brother was. And what I remember about my brother was how much he looked like my father. My 2 brothers and I spent just a few minutes looking at him.
And so Timothy Lambie Norton was born. Will Norton, the father, later wrote why they picked the name Timothy Lambie for their 4th son. Timothy was Paul's helper in New Testament evangelism and church planting. Lambie was for Dr. Thomas Lambie, a pioneering medical missionary to Ethiopia and Palestine, and a role model for the Nortons. Unfortunately, the next day, complications arose where the baby's breathing became problematic. Will Norton later wrote,
"After the doctors returned to their homes, a short respiratory issue ensued that Sunday afternoon, but then was over with. All was well until Monday, when several folks and I administered artificial respiration and stimulants."
The day he died, we were playing on the other side of the Bergman's house. I had to go back to the house for something. And when I went back to the house, Aunt Doris was working on Timmy. And my dad and Monty Sholin were there. And I came back, I said something to my brothers about wondering why they needed to be doing something on him. He was lying on the kitchen table, and they were removing congestion, I think, to help him breathe. They had tubes out and looked like they were trying to remove mucus or something like that. But anyway, when I walked back to my brother's and said that, 30 minutes later, we got one of the servants came and said that my dad wanted us. And so we went back to the house, and there was a trunk in the kitchen against one of the walls, and he asked us to sit down. And as I sat down closest to the dining room and the living room, and I noticed that Monty Scholand was sitting on one of the living room chairs blowing his nose. And so I knew that he was in tears. And so I figured there was something that was wrong with Timmy. And Peter sat next to me, and Seth sat next to Peter. And Seth had carried a bunch of orange flowers that had little brown middle part. And my dad handed one to Peter, and then he handed one to me, and then he told us that our brother had died.
It was a sad time for everyone. Timothy had lived a day and a half. It was August 29th, 1949.
I remember he was lying in his bassinet in our living room, and I can remember at night listening to my dad with the saw in the carpenter shop sawing the wood for his casket.
I can't imagine having to do that task. The sound of the electric saw is still ingrained in his mind as his dad was building the coffin for his brother. A missionary lady donated some of her wedding dress material to line the coffin and dress Timmy. Sadly, Colleen was still hemorrhaging from the delivery and too weak to attend the funeral service, so she held her son one last time before he was placed in the coffin and taken to the church. The funeral was the first service ever in the newly constructed cement block church erected in memory of Ruth Johansson Robinson. Recall, she had died 3 days after delivering her baby in 1946. All the missionaries on the field came to support the family during this time of loss. Many Europeans in the area also attended, so the service was conducted in French and Lingala. Will Jr. recounted that a moving scene was the Congolese sharing their Bibles and hymnals with the Europeans in attendance. Will Jr. also remembers the solo that Virgil Bergman sang at the service, which was,
"When he cometh, when he cometh to make up his jewels, all his jewels, precious jewels, his loved and his own. Like the stars of the morning, his bright crown adorning, they shall shine in their beauty, bright gems for his crown."
And as an aside, while interviewing Will Jr. for this episode, just him recounting the words of that song still moved him to tears 76 years later. After the interment, Will Jr. said that he remembered about 40 Congolese showing up at their house and all sitting or squatting in the front yard. They were there to support the family. They didn't say anything. Rather, the Congolese espoused the concept of presence as a way to offer support during a loss. After several hours, they all got up and left. But what a profound act of support for the grieving family. With the tragic loss of Timmy and Colleen's health still not good, the family returned to the U.S. about 6 months later and left Congo permanently. They had spent about 10 years in Congo. Colleen recounts in her book about leaving Tandala for the return to the U.S. and driving by the cemetery. She said,
"Timothy, you rest here until Jesus comes."
It was 36 years later that Will and Colleen made it back to Tandala, where they visited the gravesite of their fourth son.
When my dad was in Nigeria, they took a trip in the spring of 82 to Tandala. And my dad walked my mother to the cemetery where my brother was buried. He was buried next to Palendo. But a missionary lady, when I visited in 85, said, my mother stood there, and she may have stood there for 20 minutes. And the lady said she thought she would never stop crying. Well, it was such a shock, too. It just was a sheer shock. The child comes and then is gone, just like that.
In 1990, Will Norton Jr. visited Doris Sholand, and she recalls the cause of death being not just a lung problem, but also a heart problem. So little Timmy was buried at Tandala. The 10th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, little Timothy Lambie Norton.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Will and Colleen then went on to serve in many academic capacities. Will served as the president of Trinity College and Seminary for many years and was instrumental in securing the Deerfield, Illinois campus for the college and seminary. Then he started the master's program for missions at Wheaton College and was the dean. Then he helped establish a seminary in Nigeria. Later, he started a doctoral program for missions at Reformed Theological Seminary, teaching there for 14 years until he was 2 months shy of his 89th birthday. Colleen was a school teacher for many years in the Chicagoland area. So the tragedy of Timothy's loss and the resultant health issues to Colleen was a catalyst to new ministries impacting thousands of future pastors and missionary students over the years for the benefit of God's kingdom. By 1950, there was a sense of despair on the mission field. They needed a revival. This was due to the conflict between the Congolese church, the missionaries, and the ongoing battle of the Congolese holding on to their ways of using witchcraft as part of their culture. It wasn't uncommon for a church member, even a deacon, to be serving the church and yet acting out the tribal culture of witchcraft to fellow villagers. This brought considerable despair and a sense of helplessness from the missionaries who'd served faithfully for years, only to feel that the fruit of their efforts was rendered meaningless. While the locals had become church members, taking the next step of leadership and responsibility was not something they wanted to do. They were content in their roles. Yet, the missionaries were hoping for ongoing growth and responsibility. Others, after becoming believers, drifted back to the old ways of having multiple wives and often tried to keep them hidden from the missionaries. In effect, they were appearing to be following their newfound faith, but still had one foot in their old ways. Many Congolese pastors and church members had become complacent in their Christian walk, and many had left the faith. The missionaries began to pray for a revival, and in time, a revival came forth. Many Congolese began to feel the Spirit move, and after considerable prayer, both the missionaries and the locals began to seek conviction and a deeper commitment to their faith. Many of the church preachers were the leaders of this revival period and helped rally the church to a deeper commitment and new level of service to the church. One story was that the lead pastor at Kala, Pastor Ngutwa, had borrowed a watch from a friend but had broken it. He'd not told his friend nor taken action. Yet, he was moved to make things right, so he purchased a new watch and took it to his friend and sought forgiveness. Others, who were still practicing witchcraft, went home and put all their idols and witchcraft paraphernalia in a pile and burned it all in a huge fire. Others resisted against the evil spirits that had held the Christians in fear for years and prevailed. Numerous other examples of confessions and renewed commitment to the faith and the church took place throughout the Ubangi, both with the Congolese and missionaries alike. The spiritual life of the Congolese church was elevated. It was also during this time that the missionaries were pushing the Congolese leaders to stand on their own and begin making decisions and being accountable for themselves and the church organization. While they'd been dependent on the missionaries for virtually all financial and organizational and church governance, it was time for them to step up. They began to do so. So the change in the role of the missionary began to shift from being the leader to being a counselor. During this transition, the Congolese maintained a positive attitude of this phase and change of church governance. Pelindo, one of the prominent leaders and evangelists, expressed this well during one of the church conferences. A matter of church discipline was being discussed, and the native church was waiting for a final decisive word from some of the white missionaries. Finally, one of the missionaries said,
"This decision rests with you, brethren. You are not babies in arms anymore. You must learn to walk."
Pelindo stood up and in his calm manner pleaded,
"It is true that you have put us down on our feet, but please do not let go of our hands."
The Congolese church was coming into its own. This ongoing growth and maturity and move towards independence by the Congolese church continued in the early 1950s. Development of the various church ordinances, including baptism, governance, church discipline, and ordination of Congolese pastors, all took shape. They had to work through these issues, document them, and draft church constitutions. Things like, who was qualified to serve communion? Must one be ordained? Could a Bible Institute student administer the sacraments? Another big problem was how to deal with the woman's role in the church body. The culture was very patriarchal, where women had very few rights and men controlled all the decisions and institutions and village governance. Yet, allowing women to have ministries and leadership roles clashed with some men and the culture in general. Education, or lack of it, by many women, also played a factor in getting the women more involved in the church and its functioning. A push was made to teach women to read and write and get educated, to allow them a greater role in the church's success. All these issues were being worked through. It was a time of the missionaries providing guidance and support for the local church to stand on its own. In the early 1950s, the mission board was also facing decisions as various alliances and representative entities were being formed in Congo. The mission entity was known as the MEU, or Evangelical Mission of the Ubangi. The CPC, or Congo Protestant Council, was an umbrella organization representing numerous mission organizations in Congo. The CPC allowed for political influence with the government to protect their work throughout the country and create a spirit of collaboration and unity. Furthermore, the CPC secured government subsidies for various aspects of the mission work, school funding, hospital funding, etc. The Free Church Executive Board was hesitant about joining the CPC, but did make a small financial contribution to show support. The Free Church also added language in their church constitution to ensure that the CPC would not be allowed to directly influence its stated doctrine. In 1951, Monroe Sholand returned to the U.S. for furlough, and his purpose was to find a doctor and a builder to construct a hospital at Tandala. He enlisted Dr. John Campbell and Virgil Bergman, a builder, to come to Congo. They got Dr. Titus's commitment to return to Tandala to set up the new hospital. The Belgian government gave a $20,000 grant, and the Women's Missionary Society of the Free Church pledged to raise $25,000. Dr. Titus spent the year helping with design, plans, logistics, and other things for the new hospital. He was also hitting up people, companies, pharmacies, and the U.S. government for medical supplies for the new Tandala Hospital. So busy and focused he was that he failed to see that his wife Agnes wasn't on the same page for this next phase of life. She went to Sweden to visit relatives before the team departed to Congo. Then, in June 1953, just a few months before all the funds were committed for the new hospital, Agnes filed for divorce. Titus did not contest it, and by August 20, 1953, the divorce was granted. He was on his way back to Congo. By early November, he was at Karawa with all his supplies and a car he'd brought on the ship. He poured himself into the work of building and setting up the hospital and medical work. He was depressed in spite of the challenge, as he'd not told anybody about his divorce. And folks began to wonder when Agnes would be arriving. It was at Christmas that he shared the news of the divorce. The work progressed at amazing speed, even for Congo, with the hospital construction and setup. I now want to share a dimension of Dr. Titus that was woven throughout his entire life at every place he lived, even if it was for short periods of time. He was a gardener and a nature lover. Each mission station he helped start in the 1920s and later lived at had his handprint all over. He planted trees, gardens, shrubs, flowers, and so on. Each station had a palm lane where he planted palm trees on each side of the entry road to the mission station. These palm lanes are iconic and still remain to this day at Karawa, Tandala, Kala, and numerous other mission stations. At Tandala, he also started fish ponds and stocked them with fish. Soon, he knew he needed to return to the U.S. and take over his medical practice that Dr. Wally Thornbloom was running during his furlough. Also, news of his divorce was officially recognized, so he knew that the Free Church Mission Board would probably not allow him to continue his work, as that violated their mission charter. So on June 5, 1954, he left Tandala to return to the U.S. In typical Dr. Titus fashion, it was an adventure, which included driving, yes, driving, to East Africa, then all the way to Sweden in his car. Evelyn Noren was born into a Christian family in 1922 that prayed for her before she was even born. Her life mission was revealed during a week with her sister at Covenant Heights Church Camp in the mountains of Colorado. Many were making life commitments that week as the Holy Spirit was moving among the attendees. One night, while sleeping in bunk beds with her sister Geneva, Evelyn woke up and asked,
"What do you want?"
"I don't want anything. I'm sleeping,"
responded Geneva.
"You called me."
"No, I didn't call you."
Both went back to sleep. Then Evelyn woke up and said,
"What do you want?"
Geneva, now getting exasperated, replied,
"I don't want anything, Evelyn. I'm trying to sleep."
"But I heard my name."
Geneva began to think, then went back to sleep. Sure enough, Evelyn woke her up a third time, saying that she'd heard her name. That's when they both realized that the Lord had called Samuel three times as well, in an audible voice. Evelyn then felt the urgency to respond in some way and cried out,
"Yes, Lord, I will go where you want me to go."
She soon realized her calling was overseas mission work and began making plans for this. The first order of business was to handle her employment situation. She had just signed a teaching contract in Kansas as school was starting in a few weeks. So she went to the principal to give notice of her desired resignation. He responded that if she could find a replacement, he'd let her out of the contract. She left his office and nearly bumped into an old classmate of hers in the hallway. Her old classmate asked Evelyn if there was any chance to get a teaching job so late in the year, as she was desperate for a job. Evelyn promptly turned around, entered the principal's office, and announced,
"Here's my replacement."
It had taken less than 1 minute to find her. And for what it's worth, her former classmate went on to teach at that school for 40 years. Evelyn Noren went to Congo to be a school teacher for the missionary kids at the Ubangi Academy. She arrived on May 26, 1951. She taught about 9 kids in a one-room schoolhouse. I contacted David Lumblad, who was in fourth grade, to describe Evelyn as a teacher.
First of all, she was very musically inclined. She was a good teacher and a very patient teacher. I mean, after all, she was teaching 8-9 kids, I suppose, that were crammed into that one-room classroom. I can, even now in my mind, I can see her face and I can almost visualize, you know, her voice and everything that made her as a teacher.
One morning, she went to the school before 8 a.m. and a rainstorm began. She then went to the blackboard and wrote the verse for the day.
Proverbs 4:23. Keep your heart with all diligence, for from it flow the springs of life.
She went and sat down at a desk next to a window. All of a sudden, lightning struck. David shares about discovering Evelyn.
So we walked together as a group, and she always met us at the door. But, you know, we waited there, and she never came. So we thought, okay. So then we went back to what we call the hoosie, you know, the outdoor John. And she wasn't there. So then we went up, one of us, I suppose, I was the oldest one, and opened up the door. And she was actually killed in my desk. My desk was near the window, and it was the one furthest away from the blackboard. And she was slumped over on a chair in that place. So we kids, of course, we screamed and we ran back to the dorm. And then at that point, they got Cletus Olson there. And, you know, she was killed instantly. But I remember that it was a very traumatic thing to go through, to see your own teacher dead. And the thing we always found interesting was that the lightning, there was a big mango tree outside where you would think the lightning would have struck. But no, it came right down through the window and got her.
David describes the cause of death.
She was physically struck by lightning because when Cletus Olson came and he said that, like, she had a burn mark on the left side of her head and then a burn mark on the bottom of her one foot. So it went right through her.
It had been 1 year to the day, May 26, 1952, since her arrival that she was struck by lightning. She was buried the next day at Karawa, and all the missionaries in the Ubangi attended the service.
I think if I remember this correctly, my mom had an unused tablecloth that was used to line the casket. When we went to church then the next day, the Karawa church, of course, then they had the open coffin. I think the song that we even sang was which is interesting that it would be for a funeral. It was Jesus Keep Me Near the Cross. Today, in my mind, I've been kind of going through that song several times, reliving that whole episode. And then from there, we went to the cemetery, which, as you know, is on the edge of Karawa. Then, this thing of seeing the body or the casket being lowered then into this hole, I just remember it as being we as kids, you know, I think we spent most of our time crying because it was such a traumatic thing for us to go through.
All were saddened at her departure, seemingly in the beginning of her work, as she'd been an inspiration to all. So the 11th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Evelyn Noren.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Of interest, her brother Ed and wife Ruth Noren also came to Congo and served for many years from 1954 to 1989. And Evelyn's sister, Geneva, got married to Gordy Christensen, and they too served in Congo for many years. And one of Ed and Ruth's children, Paul, returned to Congo as an adult in the 1970s and has been serving ever since, primarily at Loco, and is even back on the field now in 2026. What a legacy from Evelyn's example and that of her family. The Karawa Mission Station was notorious for lightning strikes. In fact, several years later, Chris Ball, a student at UBOC, was also struck by lightning, though he didn't die. Storms would come from the east, across the valley, and up the hill to where Karawa was located. As the storm built its strength, the energized electrons in the clouds would look for places to go and often strike the buildings. It wasn't until the 1970s that they took measures to mitigate the danger. Geologists had come to Karawa and surveyed the area and determined a very high level of iron ore in the ground, which would explain the many lightning strikes. So at the easternmost buildings, they installed lightning rods with a wire that fed into the ground. In the ground, they dumped truck frames, radiators, and other large metal objects. This way, the electrons from the lightning would hit the rod, flow through the wire, and into the pit full of metal objects, and not affect the building or cause damage. Up to this point, the Free Church had pursued new mission stations in remote areas. But as part of the CPC, it was recommended at the 1952 MEU conference to consider establishing a mission station in an urban city. They chose Gymna as it was a regional hub for business and government, being one of the governing cities of the Ubangi region. By year-end, plans were coming together. They applied for a land concession of 5 hectares, or roughly 12 acres. They asked for a subsidy from the government for building a school. Permission was granted surprisingly quickly on May 9, 1952. The Free Church Field Council felt that Gymna should have a resident missionary. Furthermore, Tandala had considered another outpost to set up as a mission, but then decided that Gymna made more sense. There were no available missionaries to post at Gymna, so a Congolese teacher evangelist was assigned. The folks at Tandala were assigned to develop the work in Gymna. They built 2 houses and a school of mud and thatch in 1953. The Lundins went to Gymna in 1954, and in 1955, the first permanent house was constructed. The mission board had approved $1,250 to be used for building a church, with the other half coming from the Congolese church. And so the church building was constructed, and the mission work was off to a good start. The mission station added more homes, and as Gymna became a center of commerce and government business, it didn't quite fit the same mold as all the other mission stations that were located near small villages. In the early 1960s, a USAID project sponsored a farmer training school called EPOC, the acronym for the Institut Polytechnique of Congo. The program was to train village farmers improved farming practices and to teach their wives in homemaking skills. There was a separate school building for the women. The property was on a hill a few miles out of town overlooking Gymna. A few years went by. And in the 1960s, the mission opened the Evangelical College of the Ubangi. This new school would allow for theology students to stay local in the Ubangi versus going to Bolengi, which was considerable distance near Coquitlam. The Evangelical College of the Ubangi School then began sharing facilities with the Polytechnic Institute. The school operated until 1971 or so. The decision was to relocate it since it was a Christian school and sharing with the Polytechnic students wasn't a good long-range plan. This campus was on a hill outside of town a few miles, and besides the school, there were 7 or 8 houses. Our family lived there 1 year in 1970 as my dad taught at the school there. The Nelsons, Myers, Arliss Johnson, Lucy Dobbs, and Myrtle Larson all were teachers there, along with my dad. It was nice being out of the city hustle and bustle, and it had pastures with cattle and even a horse. But there was no electricity virtually the entire year we lived there. I've asked Roger Eales to share about EPOC.
We were there from 70, 71. I think there were 3 houses there and a duplex. And then Arliss was in an office lower halfway down the hill. And then there was the classroom building.
When the MEU organization split in the 1970s, the EPOC property was given to the Congolese Covenant Church. Agriculture was taught there for a few more years. By the early 1980s, there were 4 high schools and an elementary school there. They taught trades like electrical, agriculture, social sciences, mechanics, and a pedagogy curriculum. Then, in 2008, the Protestant University of the Ubangi was started by Dr. Mosai Sanguma, the then president of the Congolese Covenant Church. The university boasts a 5-year program for theology, economics, agriculture, and medicine. So what started out as a small school to teach farming and home economics is now a flourishing campus with multiple schools teaching numerous disciplines to thousands of students. As part of the original land concession for the Gymnum Mission, 10 acres had been set aside for a school. So with the decision for the Evangelical College to leave the Epoch campus, Lee Hegel began building a four-room classroom building along with a dormitory and a house for a principal. The classroom and dormitory were ready for occupancy in early January 1972. By mid-1973, there were 5 faculty residences, 2 school buildings with multiple classrooms, a volleyball court, a soccer field, a dirt basketball court, and a dorm building for boarding some of the students. This school was later renamed Institute Kemia, which means Institute Peace. It was there that our family moved in 1973, as there was a mission station there and also the school campus for the high school. My dad taught there from 1973 to 1990 and was principal for part of 1 year. I taught English and chemistry at Institute Kemia in 1982 when I was a short-termer and a gopher for a year. As with most buildings, they became multi-purpose, and so by the 1990s, there were elementary school classes being held in the afternoons while the high school classes were taught in the morning. This allowed the high school pedagogy students to perform student teaching. As time went on, Gymnum grew around the mission station, and as the city grew, multiple church parishes were established to serve the people. In the 1980s, it was estimated that 75,000 to 100,000 people lived in Gymnum. When I visited in 2013, I was told that close to 300,000 lived in the Gymnum metropolitan area. In the 1970s, the government hired a British construction company called Wimpey to construct and enlarge the airport and build a terminal building. This was big time, having a full-fledged airport that could handle commercial jets and military planes. The new runway was about 6,300 feet long. There was actually a paved street around the terminal building about 200 yards long. That's where I learned to drive. On my 14th birthday, my dad and I headed to the airport. The vehicle was a Peugeot 404 pickup truck, 3-speed stick shift, 3 on the tree, for those of you old enough to know what that is. Another aspect of Gymnum was it being the regional government hub. There was a bank. Yes, a bank. Not multiple banks, just one. This was for an area roughly the size of Illinois. There were other governmental offices for different things. There was a post office that was operational into the 1970s, but after that, the postal service really didn't work. There were stores, and when the barges could get upriver in the rainy season, they were stocked, somewhat, with a few items. Also in the 1970s, there was a TV station built that transmitted from atop Epoch Hill, though only a few folks had TV sets in town. And then you had to hope and pray that there was diesel fuel to power the generators so you could actually have electricity for your TV set to watch a European soccer game beamed in from satellite. Gymnum was a vibrant city with stores, a post office, and the only bank in the entire region, as mentioned. As such, resident missionaries were constantly hosting travelers passing through or needing a place to stay. Gymnum was also a departure or entry point for many missionaries traveling in and out of the country via Bangui, Central African Republic. With the Mission Aviation Fellowship airplane, it was under an hour to fly from Gymnum to Bangui. And with commercial flights being more dependable to and from Europe via Bangui, most people traveled home to the U.S. through Bangui instead of Kinshasa. Also, with the Congo Postal Service being lousy or non-existent, we set up a mailbox in Bangui for all missionary mail. It was Post Office Box 1377. So each time the plane went to Bangui, it came back with lots of mail for all the missionaries in the Ubangi region. So between handling shopping for the remote mission stations, meeting the planes for customs and immigration duties, hospitality for travelers, and being a hub for considerable church and mission business, being stationed in Gymnum meant you were always busy. I've asked Roger and Sally Eels, my parents, to share a few thoughts on Gymnum. Our family lived there in 1970, then from 1973 to 1990.
So there was a WMS house built in 79 or 80. Hegel's house, the big house we lived in 73, 74, guest house you stayed in, Wycliffe House. So that's five dwellings.
Being a hub for the airplanes and truck traffic and business, it was a busy station.
I liked the fact that we had not just Free Church missionaries that we would have had on any Free Church station, but also we had Covenant, we had Habitat for Humanity missionaries, Wycliffe, and so Sunday night service, church service was just like home because we had all those people from different backgrounds and so forth. So I really liked that.
Dad was a high school teacher at Institute Kemia.
As a high school teacher, the advantage of Gemino was the many opportunities to evangelize with the 16 high schools in town, which you couldn't have done in Tondala. You just had your one high school, or Kala. You just had your one church school there and all the students sitting there, and that was it. Whereas Gemina had 16 schools, and so the opportunities were just unimaginable for ministry among all those students. So that's what I found. Gemina was special.
Being the urban setting that it was, it allowed ministry to impact many more people than the typical mission station in a remote area.
Well, it's interesting that the different ministries that I had while I was a teacher at Kemia was the film ministry, of course. We had students from all the 16 schools into our house and doing Emmaus courses, had over 900 students during those years. Worked with the Gideons. They were based in Gemina, so I helped them with passing out scriptures. So those were neat things to do. And as a result, back in 2019, one of my former students from the 1980s decided to do something what I did. And so they established a cultural center in Gemina, and they named it the Roger Eels Cultural Center of Gemina, where they are doing outreaches to high school students today through the different ways I did it, movies, discipleship, English classes, all those kinds of things.
A big event was the showing of the Jesus film in Gemina.
I remember one of the best things was organizing the Gemina Crusade using the Jesus film in 1987, where we got the 13 Seku churches together, and we showed the movie 16 times. And in preparation for all the crusade and showing the Jesus film to all those times, over 600 people in the churches formed 50 different prayer groups. And then 12,000 paper invitations were passed around in the different neighborhoods by the local church. And as a result, 20,000 people saw the film, Jesus. So it was quite a significant event.
So the ministries continued to grow in Gemina and the surrounding areas. The large population base opened new doors for ministry that didn't exist in most of the mission stations that were in distant areas. New ministries started in Gemina in the 2000s, included a school for disabled children headed by Rachel Martin Balia. Then a cultural center for teens started in 2019 that used films and discussions and trainings to reach the youth. And most recently, Claudine Selenga is starting Tabitha Centers. There are over 200 Tabitha Centers in Kinshasa, the capital. These centers take street girls off the street and provide training in a skill set like cosmetics, hospitality, or sewing. This allows them a chance to leave their street life and pursue a better life. And the church parishes continue to minister to those in their neighborhoods and communities. In conclusion of this third episode in the series, we discussed the procurement and construction of Wasolo, Libengi, Baja, and Gemina. Also, there were the people who gave their lives in the process, Timothy Lambie Norton and Evelyn Norin. The loss of little Timothy Norton was one reason their family returned to the States, and the tragic loss of Evelyn Norton by lightning just seemed senseless. But all these saints did not die in vain. I was forwarded considerable materials from the Free Church Archives from Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester to help put this episode together. I read numerous books and reports that will be noted in the final episode. The effort and foresight of those writers to preserve history is to be recognized. I extend appreciation to Dan Noren, Dean and Gretchen Samuelson, Bev Nyberg, Jay Dangers, and Roger and Sally Eels for sharing their insights to the various mission stations, Wasolo, Libengi, Baja, and Gemina. And to Will Norton Jr. for sharing the personal story of his little brother, Timothy Lambie Norton, who passed away in 1949. And to David Lundblad for his memories of Evelyn Norton's death. Thanks also to the many folks who provided voiceovers for the characters in this episode to help bring the stories to life. In episode 4 of this series, we will present the period of 1953 to 1962 of our mission work in the northwest corner of Congo. You will hear about the country gaining independence and the subsequent evacuation in 1960. Then, political turmoil ensued. 4 more people die on the field, and you will hear their amazing stories. The mission work continued despite the obstacles. Thank you for listening, and I hope you continue the journey with me and listen to the next episode of Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eels, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninga nangai, tikalamalamu. My friends, stay well.